This is InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's what's happening on this week's show.
Job discrimination is not allowed in U.S. workplaces, but one expert says it's still very real, as blacks remain less likely to be hired and rarely progress to senior positions.
50-plus years after the Civil Rights Act and in the midst of a multi-billion dollar diversity industry, we still have so little racial diversity present in our workplaces.
Then, parents of teenagers may be surprised by the powerful emotions that can affect teens. An expert offers tips for parents on how to support their teens in distress.
It's very hard to be a parent of a teenager because teenagers feel things more intensely than children and adults do, and it's pretty potent sometimes, their emotional lives.
Those two stories and more are ahead on this week's show. InfoTrack begins right after this.
Discover, this is Danny.
Hi, it's Jen Coolidge. I just want to thank you for making me feel so special. I earned cash back on debit for my dinner party groceries.
That's great. But with Discover Cashback Debit, we give everyone cash back on everyday purchases. Anything else I can help you with?
Are you hungry? Because everyone left after the asparagus sorbet.
Introducing Discover Cashback Debit, a checking account with cash back. It pays to Discover. Eligibility and terms at discover.com/cashbackdebit. Discover Bank, member FDIC.
The new iPhone 15 Pro with titanium is here. Switch to my plan from Verizon at your local store today, and you'll get the amazing new iPhone 15 Pro on us with Unlimited Ultimate when you trade in any iPhone, any model, any condition. Guaranteed. Yep, even the old phone in your pocket right now. It's your Verizon. $999.99, 128 gigabyte only. Device payment purchase or full retail purchase with new smartphone line on Unlimited Ultimate plan required. Less $1,000 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. Promo credit ends if eligibility requirements are no longer met. 0% APR.
I can't wait for what's next. Even with higher stroke risk due to atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem, Eliquis, apixaban tablets, reduces stroke risk. It's the number one cardiologist-prescribed blood thinner.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without talking to your doctor, as this may increase your risk of stroke. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or have antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or unusual bruising, or if you have tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. It may increase your bleeding risk if you take medicines such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's your host, Chris Whitting.
Despite today's multi-billion dollar diversity industry, our next guest says workplace inequality is still very real. We welcome Adia Harvey Wingfield to InfoTrack. She is a sociologist, professor at Washington University in St. Louis, and author of Gray Areas, How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. Adia, can you elaborate on what you mean by gray areas in the workplace?
Sure. When I talk about gray areas, I'm talking about the parts of work that may not necessarily be embedded in our jobs, but are still really relevant for how we work and how we move ahead. So, for example, I'm a college professor. My job is to research and teach and to do service. But there are other parts that are associated with my work, too, and those have to do with my connections that help me to find the jobs that I have had They relate to the organizational culture in the jobs where I have been employed. And there's the relational parts of work that relate to the advancement, my opportunities to move ahead in my job. And so those social dynamics, those cultural parts of work, the relationships that we have, those are the gray areas where I argue that we see opportunities for racial inequality to be perpetuated in ways that continue to limit Black workers.
Your research involved interviews with hundreds of Black professionals. Were there any overarching themes or patterns that stood out in their shared experiences?
Yes, some of the overarching themes that I note had to do with the ways in which Black workers were often less likely to be able to rely on social networks to move into certain jobs, and the challenges that they faced in organizational cultures that consistently relied on more of a colorblind approach in ways that made companies very unable to see the challenges and deal with the challenges that Black workers faced. So I'll give you a quick example. There was Kevin, who I spoke to, who worked at a nonprofit that was focused on educational improvement. And while the nonprofit had a culture of collaboration and working together, they also were colorblind in ways that meant that it was really difficult for them to listen to Kevin when he tried to point out patterns in how Black families often were negatively treated in that space. There was just no language for people at the company to understand and deal with and try to rectify that issue.
Can you talk about the disparity in authority recognition, even when Black workers hold high status jobs?
Sure. One of the things that I learned from this project was that for Black workers in high status jobs, that status often does not communicate the authority and respect that one might think it does. So, for example, Max is an emergency medicine doctor that I profiled for the study. And you might think that as a doctor, he's got it made. He's in this high ranking job and he's got the status associated with being a physician. But he still, even with that title and that status, encountered patients who would tell him point blank, I'm not going to let you treat me and I'll sue you if you don't get me a white doctor. So just being in that position of being a doctor and having the associated status that comes with that did not protect Black workers from slights and insults like that.
Many companies rely on what I think you would call outdated strategies to deal with racial disparities. What modern effective strategies would you recommend they use?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there are things that evidence shows us actually do work to address some of these issues. For one thing, companies can diversify the way that they think about hiring. If we know that most people find jobs through their connections and their social networks, one thing that companies can do is to reach out of the networks that they already have. And hiring managers can make it a point to visit historically Black colleges and universities, because data has shown that when they do, they are often exposed to a wealth of new talent, new ideas, new eager, hungry young people that otherwise aren't in their networks and they wouldn't know about. Similarly, companies can think about instituting mentoring programs for all instead of just letting mentoring happen organically or people picking and choosing who gets to be involved in a mentoring program. And people might think, well, why can't mentoring just happen the way that it happens? Why can't you just organically form mentoring? Well, again, the data shows that when that happens, Black workers are more likely to be left out of those relationships. But when there is a formal mentoring program that anyone has access to, then Black workers are more likely to sign up and they are more likely to be matched with people who then are willing to go to bat for them.
Our guest is Adia Harvey Wingfield. Her book is Gray Areas: How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. You've spent a decade researching this topic. Have you seen the landscape evolve for Black workers in the United States?
You know, it's interesting. I don't think that it's necessarily evolved in a linear pattern. So, for example, a few years ago in 2020, we were in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement, and we saw many companies pledging their support for eradicating systemic racism and devoting resources to that end. Now, just 3 years later, we're certainly not in that same cultural space anymore. And we're seeing legal decisions that challenge the legitimacy of affirmative action and many companies retreating as a result. So I think it's hard to make a case that we're seeing consistent forward progress and more so that we are seeing two steps forward and one step back when it comes to these issues of race in the workplace.
Why do you believe that mandated diversity training doesn't really work very well?
Yeah, that might be surprising because diversity training is so commonplace. But data also shows that when it is mandated, it does not really succeed. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One is that mandated diversity trainings often make white workers feel resentful. They feel as if they are being blamed and they feel as if they are being held responsible for racial issues that they may not necessarily feel as if they are a part of. And so it makes them often shut down and not want to be part of thinking about solutions. And perhaps counterintuitively, I've also found that for Black workers, diversity trainings that are mandated don't do much. They feel as if it's more of an effort for organizations to show that they are in compliance with legal regulations than it is an effort for organizations to address the types of issues that really affect them, like I try to talk about in gray areas. So on both counts, these types of initiatives don't really strike a chord with Black or white workers, and they ultimately, as the data show, do not lead to a higher number of Black workers represented in leadership or managerial roles.
In light of the current demographic changes happening in our country, what are the long-term implications if gray areas are not addressed?
To me, that's one of the big concerns in writing the book. Our demographics in the U.S. are changing. We are becoming an increasingly more diverse and multiracial society. And it's just hard for me to see how a modern democracy continues along that front if we know that workers of color in particular, and Black workers specifically, continue to be marginalized and face additional obstacles in moving into the workforce. Ultimately, what I think we're left with are work environments and workforces that do not look like the broader population of America. And I just don't see how that is a recipe for success when the companies where we work are so disconnected from the populations that they serve.
Adia, what message do you hope that readers take away from your work?
I hope that readers come away with a better and more precise understanding of how these racial inequalities persist and how 50 plus years after the Civil Rights Act and in the midst of a multi-billion dollar diversity industry, we still have so little racial diversity present in our workplace. But I also hope readers come away with some ideas for things that they can do. And I've included some checklists in the book and suggestions for readers about things that they can do in their workplaces to try to address these issues. So I hope that both of those things are takeaways.
What do you think of the media's push for diversity in terms of casting and presenters, you know, on camera? Is that helping or is it not making much of a difference?
Well, it depends. And I think there are two questions to be asked when it comes to these issues of diversity, because we want to not only make sure that workplaces reflect representative diversity, but also that once people move into organizations, they are able to feel as if they're fully welcome and that their experiences are recognized and part of the organizational fabric. So I think if companies are just pushing for diversity in terms of numbers, they might get that, but they won't necessarily see that last unless they also are thinking about how those who they have brought in are able to fully enmesh into the organization.
Adia Harvey Wingfield, author of Gray Areas, How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking to you.
Next, how parents can help their teenagers manage their emotions. That story, coming up.
You're listening to InfoTrack. More after this.
Discover, this is Danny.
Hi, it's Jen Coolidge. I just want to thank you for making me feel so special. I earned cash back on debit for my dinner party groceries.
That's great. But with Discover Cashback Debit, we give everyone cash back on everyday purchases. Anything else I can help you with?
Are you hungry? Because everyone left after the asparagus sorbet.
Introducing Discover Cashback Debit, a checking account with cash back. It pays to Discover. Eligibility and terms at discover.com/cashbackdebit. Discover Bank, member FDIC.
Yo, J Balvin here. Verizon just hooked me up with a new iPhone 15 Pro with titanium. How can you get one? By switching to my plan at your Verizon store, get the amazing new iPhone 15 Pro on them. When you trade in any iPhone, any model, any condition, guaranteed. And listen to my new song, Dientes, on your way to get the new iPhone 15 Pro.
Don't miss out. Switch to my plan from Verizon today. It's your Verizon. $999.99, 128GB only. Device payment purchase or full retail purchase with new smartphone line on unlimited ultimate plan required. Less $1,000 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. Promo credit ends if eligibility requirements are no longer met. 0% APR.
I can't wait for what's next. Even with higher stroke risk due to atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem, Eliquis, apixaban tablets, reduces stroke risk. It's the number one cardiologist prescribed blood thinner.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without talking to your doctor, as this may increase your risk of stroke. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or have antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or unusual bruising, or if you have tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. It may increase your bleeding risk if you take medicines such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
InfoTrack continues. Once again, here's Chris Whitting.
Teenagers can experience intense emotions. Parents need to understand this in order to support their teens through this developmental stage. With more, here's InfoTrack's Roy Mackey. Roy?
Thanks, Chris. Dr. Lisa DeMore hosts the Ask Lisa podcast, writes about adolescence for the New York Times, and serves as a senior advisor to the Schubert Center for Child Studies at Case Western Reserve University. She's now the author of The Emotional Lives of Teenagers, Raising Connected, Capable, and Compassionate Adolescents. Dr. DeMore, you begin your book addressing three myths about adolescent emotion, so let's just start there. The first one is that emotion is the enemy of reason. That's kind of an interesting one because I think many people think that emotions do cause people of all ages to act impulsively or illogically. So tell us why that is a myth for teenagers.
Well, so there are times for sure when emotions can get the better of us and cause us to make decisions that are not wise ones. But for the most part, the way that psychologists regard emotion is we see them as informational. They are giving us feedback on our lives and how things are going. And we want teenagers, and actually people of all ages, to tune in to what's happening in their feelings to help them make good decisions. So, for example, if a young person finds that every time they hang out with a particular classmate or friend, they come away from it feeling kind of lousy, we would want them to pay attention to that information and to use it to make decisions going forward. But we also want emotions to be balanced with other things. One of the analogies I offer in that section is the idea that emotions should be like one member of our personal board of directors. If we imagine that we all have a board of directors that helps us make choices in our life, there's a lot of, you know, people sitting at that table. There are obligations to others, our ethics, our values, our financial and logistical constraints, but also our feelings weigh in, what we want to do. And I think the best way to think about it is that emotions have a seat at the board. They are not the chair of the board, and they're very rarely the deciding vote.
The second myth you write about is that difficult emotions are bad for teens.
I think it's very hard to be a parent of a teenager and be in the presence of how intense their distress can become. And it is natural to adolescents that teenagers sometimes have very powerful feelings, and it can be frightening to the teenager and also frightening to the parent because teenagers feel things more intensely than children and adults do. And it's pretty potent sometimes, their emotional lives. And I know sometimes that parents worry that it's bad for their kid to feel some distress at a very high level. And what we know is that by and large, teenagers and people of all ages are built to weather intense emotions, are able to withstand them, and in fact, grow from them. So not only not be harmed by them, but in fact, gain maturity by going through hard experiences and sitting with painful emotions. And only occasionally do we find that having a very, very intense emotional experience causes harm. And that's what we refer to as trauma, when somebody faces something totally overwhelming that really blows their coping out of the water. We don't want that for teenagers, but teenagers learn and grow sometimes the most when they're dealing with difficult things.
The third myth that you write about is that with their amped up emotions, teens are psychologically fragile. Set us straight on that myth.
It can be kind of awesome to witness how intense teens' emotions can be and also how all over the place they can be. Teens feel everything more powerfully, so that also means they feel positive emotions powerfully. So anyone raising a teenager is going to have the experience that their kid is in a terrible mood and then 5 minutes later is like ecstatic about something. And at any other point in life, we might be a little bit concerned about how wildly mood can swing in a very short space of time. But in teenagers, we see this as largely normative. And what I would want parents to be on the lookout for in terms of when to worry about the fragility of their teenager is if their teenager is dominated by negative emotions, finds that negative emotions are running the show for them, making decisions for them, getting in the way of their life, or if their teenager is using costly coping, is what I call it, if they're using strategies to feel better that come with a price tag, such as using substances or tearing at the fabric of relationships or being harmful to themselves.
You also write quite a lot about gender differences, and I think parents who've raised both boys and girls would certainly agree that there are some huge differences. What do parents need to know about that?
What parents should know is that the gender differences we see in terms of how kids experience and express emotion are socialized. They're taught to kids. There's nothing inborn that makes girls do things one way and boys do things another. But we do see very powerful gendered patterns that emerge. And what we see is that girls are given a lot more latitude around emotion. They are allowed by our culture to express a very wide range of feelings, from sad to angry to frustrated. Whereas boys are taught by our culture that there's only a couple of emotions that are really permissible for them. And those emotions are anger or pleasure at someone else's expense. So that is harmful to boys, obviously, because they don't get to feel all the time that they can enjoy a rich emotional life, at least not in a public way. And we also find that boys don't develop the same vocabulary that girls do for talking about feelings, connecting with people around emotions. And this comes at a cost to them, and of course, also the people around them.
I think many parents view phones and social media as the greatest enemy in the history of parenting. What are your thoughts on that?
It's complicated, is I think what I would say, is that phones for teenagers and social media for teenagers is a very mixed experience. I don't think there's a teenager around who doesn't simultaneously really, really value and enjoy what happens for them online and also find what happens online to be taxing or frustrating or painful for them. That in my experience clinically, I see all the time that those experiences live side by side. And so what this means is that if, as adults, we're going to try to guide teenagers about social media or talk with them about their online lives, we first need to acknowledge that for teenagers, there's a lot of upside in this and a lot that they enjoy and a lot that actually may be quite healthy for them. And if we acknowledge that, then I think we have a fighting chance of having a conversation about the downsides. But if we just roll up on teenagers and talk with them about how we hate their phones and social media, we will have lost them before the conversation has even started. So I think it's really important that adults be curious and ask questions of their teenager about what do you like about social media? What do you dislike? What is it that adults don't understand? And really have a meaningful conversation before trying to weigh in with our opinions or our guidance.
Any tips for parents on what they can do to help their teenagers maintain or regain emotional control?
One of the key things I really tried to bring across in this book is that psychologists see the act of emotion regulation, what you're describing, you know, being able to bring feelings, you know, to a place that makes them bearable and quite manageable, is a complex and kind of wonderful process. And it actually has a couple of categories in which teenagers can operate. Sometimes teenagers gain relief for powerful emotions by expressing them, talking about them, getting them out physically, sometimes going for a run or banging on drums. And sometimes teenagers bring emotions down to size by finding things that help them to regain a sense of control, whether it's comforting themselves or finding a temporary distraction or tackling the problem that gave rise to the distress. And more than anything, what I want parents to know is that sometimes talking about feelings works really well for teenagers, but that is certainly not the only or even always the best option, that there are lots and lots of ways for teenagers to manage emotions well that may or may not involve opening up to their parents.
Dr. Lisa Dumore, the author of The Emotional Lives of Teenagers, Raising Connected, Capable, and Compassionate Adolescents. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And for InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
You're listening to InfoTrack, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago.
Discover, this is Danny.
Hi, it's Jen Coolidge. I just want to thank you for making me feel so special. I earned cash back on debit for my dinner party groceries.
That's great. But with Discover Cashback Debit, we give everyone cash back on everyday purchases. Anything else I can help you with?
Are you hungry? Because everyone left after the asparagus sorbet.
Introducing Discover Cashback Debit, a checking account with cash back. It pays to Discover. Eligibility and terms at discover.com/cashbackdebit. Discover Bank, member FDIC.
Yo, J Balvin here. Verizon just hooked me up with a new iPhone 15 Pro with titanium. How can you get one? By switching to my plan at your Verizon store, get the amazing new iPhone 15 Pro on them. When you trade in any iPhone, any model, any condition, guaranteed. And listen to my new song, Dientes, on your way to get the new iPhone 15 Pro.
Don't miss out. Switch to my plan from Verizon today. It's your Verizon. $999.99, 128GB only. Device payment purchase or full retail purchase with new smartphone line on unlimited ultimate plan required. Less $1,000 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. Promo credit ends if eligibility requirements are no longer met. 0% APR.
Now, InfoTrack continues. Once again, here's Chris Whitting.
Recent research has found that women who don't get enough sleep are at risk of developing a worrisome medical disorder. Here with this story, InfoTrack's Gina Tedesco. Gina?
Thanks, Chris. The Centers for Disease Control says more than 35% of adults in the U.S. do not get enough sleep at night. And now, women have an extra reason to be sure they get enough shut-eye. Joining us now is Shahab Hakoyep, a Ph.D. research fellow at the Brigham and Harvard Medical School. Doctor, the school is out with a study showing a correlation between lack of sleep and high blood pressure in women. First off, can you characterize how concerned you are with the findings and how concerned women should be?
More than 30% of people have some symptoms of insomnia or don't get enough sleep. On the other hand, high blood pressure and hypertension is also very prevalent. So we know that both of these conditions are associated with other health outcomes. I mean, for example, hypertension is associated with higher risk of stroke or cardiovascular diseases. Same thing for sleep, it's associated with different negative health outcomes.
Now, this was a massive study that you did. You followed more than 66,000 women over 16 years. So, first off, what types of data did you collect on their health and activity?
This is a study that started in the 1980s. Most of the data is collected using questionnaires every other year and asked if they started a new medication, physical activity and their type of diet, how much alcohol they use, their work schedule if they have night shift work, and also, like, for example, their body mass index and, of course, their age.
Of the 66,000 you studied, all of whom, by the way, had no hypertension when the study began, it turns out that 39% did develop hypertension during the course of the study. Was this surprisingly high?
No, not actually, because as I mentioned, there are about 45% of adults living with high blood pressure.
And you mentioned some of the factors that you did look at. So for those women with problems sleeping, didn't they have certain characteristics that were higher or more troubling, such as higher body mass indexes?
Yes, there was association between some of these parameters, like the higher body mass index. We found association also with, for example, the amount of alcohol they use or if they are smoking or not. So yeah, these are also associated with sleep problems.
Doctor, according to your study, how many hours of sleep was, shall we say, the bar? In other words, getting less sleep than the bar was when you saw a risk of developing hypertension.
The recommendation of American Academy of Sleep Medicine is to get 7 or more hours of sleep. We consider people who get 7 to 8 hours as our reference and look at the other groups. And we found that for people who get less than 7 hours, the risk was higher than people who get 7 to 8 hours of sleep.
We spoke before about the negative consequences of hypertension, but you noted a chain of negative outcomes that could occur even before the patient gets hypertension, such as retaining more sodium. What were some of the others?
From different studies, what they found is that one explanation can be when we have sleep difficulties, it causes increase in sodium retention, and then after that, that caused the change in arterial stiffness, and then that caused the hypertension. The other explanation that different studies found and is one of our hypotheses is that when we have the disruption in our sleep-wake cycle, it influences the constriction and relaxation activity of the vessels. So basically, the vessels don't open up as much as we expect, in, for example, during a sleep time or at the time that we expect.
And doctor, remind us about behaviors, particularly around bedtime, that might interfere with a person's ability to get to sleep or stay asleep.
You shouldn't use your phone or your laptop close to your bedtime. If you can take a warm bath or shower like 1 or 2 hours before your sleep time, that can help you to fall asleep faster and get better quality of sleep. The room temperature is also important. Have a cooler room temperature. Also some kind of meditation or relaxation before sleep time can help you to have better sleep and better quality of sleep.
And finally, doctor, while this study only focused on women, do you believe it's at least a warning for men as well?
Actually, I personally think that we will see same pattern in male as well.
Shahab Hakoyep, researcher at the Brigham and Harvard Medical School. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
For InfoTrack, I'm Gina Tedesco.
That wraps up another edition of InfoTrack. InfoTrack Internet services are provided by Pear.com. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Chris Whitting, inviting you to join us next week for another edition of InfoTrack.
Rebooting your radio with the Valley's fun music. 105.7 CFW.
This is 105.7 CFW.
Brando, Jimmy Dean, on the cover of a magazine. Grace Kelly, Harlow Jean, picture of a beauty queen. Jean Kelly, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, dance on air. They had style, they had grace. Rita Hayworth gave good face. Lauren Catherine Manitou, Betty Davis, we love you. Ladies with an attitude, fellas that were in the mood. Don't just stand there, let's get to it. Strike a pose, there's nothing to it.
This is 105.7 CFW.
There's a story in my eyes. Turn the pages of desire. Now it's time to trade those dreams for the rush of passion's fire. I can feel you tremble when we touch, and I feel the hand of fate reaching out to both of us. I've been holding back the night. I've been searching for the hands of fate.
much a part of the valley as Big Falls and Beaver Creek Reserve. This is 105.7 CFW, the valley's fun music.
CFW. Thank you. Meteorologist Rodney Price, mostly cloudy skies, 56 degrees in the late day with light south winds. Rain chances increasing overnight. We'll see lows around 44. Rain chances ending early Monday, mostly cloudy skies. Our afternoon high will top out at 61. Right now it's 37.
CFW.
Billy or Mac or Buddy, and he's played ugly.
1057 CFW. If you've been in the Valley for a while, you know that WCFW's always been the station where FM stands for fine music.
This is WCFW, where FM means fine music.
Well, we think in addition to fine music, FM can also stand for fun music. The Valley station for fine music and fun music is here. Tell a friend about 1057 CFW.
The Valley's Fun Music, 105.7 CFW, is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Bug Tussle Wireless.
Bug Tussle.
I'm Martin Hoke, the inventor of Navage Nasal Care, and I love Navage. I've told you about how your nose is the body's air filter, that Navage's powered suction will help flush out allergens, viruses, mucus, and germs, and that Navage will help you breathe better. But what do other people say about Navage?